Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 28th of November. A little bit of open lines, a few more phone calls here on our question, our listener question for you to answer. What is your favorite season of the church year? Given the fact that we're right at the beginning of the church year, a good time to contemplate these things. And why is it your favorite season of the church year? Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In addition, if you can think of a hymn from that season of the church year to toss in, feel free. Coming up in a few minutes, Dave Smith will join us from Protect Marriage Illinois. We'll talk about the gay marriage advisory referendum that is working its way across the state of Illinois. Greg Kokel will join us to answer the question, where is God in disaster? Uwe Simonetto will be our guest in the last hour of the program. We continue our weekly conversation with him on vocation. We'll talk about ourselves, Christians, as media consumers. All of us are media consumers. Uwe will bring his insight in the last 45 minutes of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Meredith in Clayton. Meredith, thank you for waiting, and welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi.
Hi.
My favorite season, I actually have two. The first is Advent, and the second is Christmas. And I love Advent because it leads into Christmas, and the idea of Emmanuel, God is with us, is housed in the season of Advent. And then that kind of the first fulfillment of that comes through in Christmas. And also the Christmas season houses my favorite hymn, which is Of the Father's Love Begotten.
Oh, that's a great hymn, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a marvelous, a very old hymn, too. Very, very old hymn. Meredith, thank you for the call. I don't know. See, it's hard for me to make up my mind. If I had to choose one, you know, you say, if you could be, like we say with the seasons of the year, if it could be one season all year round, believe me, I come from Texas, and we have that. It's called summer. We actually just have summer and fall. Very little spring, very little winter. And it's not that great. The changing of the seasons of the year is the kind of thing that we use to mark time here in the world. The changings of the seasons in the church. It's the way the church marks time until Christ comes again. Millie and Jane, callers from the previous segment, give us a call back. I'm going to send you each, according to the season that you chose. I think, can't remember what Jane's was, but Millie's was Advent. This booklet and this CD, Hymns of the Faithful. Give us a call back, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dave Smith joins us to talk about something you may have read in the paper. St. Louis Post-Dispatch headline, read, State may see gay marriage fight. We're going to talk about an advisory referendum working its way across the state of Illinois with the goal of swinging lawmakers' minds and changing their minds toward amending the Illinois state constitution. Dave Smith is project director for Protect Marriage Illinois. Dave, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd, so much.
What is this referendum? What is the content of it? How would it, at least in a symbolic way, express the will of the Illinois voters?
Well, it's actually a non-binding referendum that we're trying to get on the ballot for November 2006 that would call on the Illinois General Assembly to pass an amendment to our state constitution defining marriage as a union of one man, one woman, as God defined it. I could read you the exact quote, if you like, of what we're trying to add to the Illinois state constitution.
Please do.
Okay, it says, to secure and preserve the benefits of marriage for our society and for future generations of children, a marriage between a man and a woman is the only legal union that shall be valid or recognized in this state. And, Todd, as you probably know, Missouri has already passed it. 15 other states have already passed similar state amendments to their state constitutions in response to what the Massachusetts Supreme Court did in 2004. And the average vote has been over 71%. In fact, Texas was the last one. You were speaking about being from Texas. Well, Texas was the last one that did it at 76%. So 3 out of 4 of Texans voted to preserve marriage as one man, one woman.
I would like your response to a few things. These come from Rick Garcia, who is from the gay rights group called Equality Illinois. And first of all, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch piece, he says that this petition organization is really just an attempt to build up a mailing list for the various supporting organizations. How do you respond?
Yeah, that's absolutely false. What we're trying to do is to influence our state legislators. In Illinois, we have a very liberal constitution. It's probably one of the most liberal state constitutions in the union. It doesn't allow the people to come directly for a vote. It has to. An amendment like this must go through the General Assembly first. And for 2 years, we've tried to do that, but Chicago Democrats and some of their allies in moderate Republicans have bottled up our amendment in the Rules Committee and not let it come to a vote. And we're fully confident that if it did come to a vote, we would get the two-thirds vote needed in the General Assembly, which would then bring it to the vote for the people. So our only last resort we have is to actually take an advisory referendum, which is non-binding, but it is a public opinion poll, an official poll of the people of Illinois, and put pressure on House Speaker Michael Madigan and others in the Illinois General Assembly to allow this to come to a vote. And, you know, it's nothing to do with trying to build up a database. What we're trying to do is to protect marriage for our children and for grandchildren and for their children.
How do you respond to those? And this is also part of the comments in the Post-Dispatch piece from Rick Garcia of Equality Illinois. How do you respond to those who say, look, this is akin to kind of public opinion and the issue of interracial marriage in the 60s? And people didn't want interracial marriage in the 60s, but in the end, this is what we have, and this is, and it turned out to be a good thing after all. The same thing is true, they say, of gay marriage.
Right. Well, homosexual activists and their liberal allies tend to try to go back to the civil rights thing. It's akin to, you know, being black or being Hispanic. But my boss, Peter LaBarbera, with the Illinois Family Institute, has always said, and I'm going to repeat what he says, is that, you know, have you ever met an ex-black person or an ex-gay Latino? Well, there are hundreds of ex-gays out there who have, many of them have transformed their lives, come out of the homosexual lifestyle, which is just a behavior, thanks to the, you know, the power of Jesus Christ in their life. And, you know, you can't abstain from being black. You can't abstain from being a woman, but you can abstain from homosexual activity. And that's what this is. Government shouldn't be in the business of promoting and protecting a very dangerous and unhealthy lifestyle.
What is the lay of the land when it comes to most states and the gay marriage issue, especially with regard to constitutional bans or referenda? I know that at least 11 states, it was a big issue in the 2004 November elections. How do you draw the picture nationwide on this issue, banning gay marriage?
Well, if you look at Ohio alone in 2004, it was interesting to note that 39,000 Amish people who never come to vote registered to vote because they believed in this issue so strongly. And not only that, but 497,000 people who voted for John Kerry for president also voted for this marriage initiative to protect marriage. So it's not a religious right issue. It is a family issue. Protecting family. It cuts across all racial lines. It's not a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's a family issue.
This, again, is Rick Garcia of Equality Illinois, quoting from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He says, these people, that is those who are supporting the advisory referendum to ban gay marriage in Illinois, these people no more care about families than the man on the moon. If they wanted to protect families, why aren't they pushing for a ban on divorce? Divorce ruins more families than any gay person ever has. Your response?
Well, divorce is a terrible, infecting problem in American lifestyle. I would agree that we need to work to reduce divorce. In fact, I would advocate getting rid of no-fault divorce, but that's not the current problem here. Right now, we've got an infection in one leg. We need to cut out that infection. We don't cut off both legs because one leg has gangrene. We need to preserve marriage as one man, one woman, and then work on the issue of divorce as well. Absolutely.
Any idea about what the governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, what he might do with regard to this referendum, what he could do?
Well, we just saw him in February sign a homosexual rights bill into law, and he celebrated it on Martin Luther King's birthday, saying, you know, equating it with civil rights. His sister-in-law happens to be a homosexual activist as well. And it would be my opinion that he would support the homosexual and liberal forces trying to stop what we're doing here with the marriage amendment.
Why is Illinois, at least on this issue and perhaps many others, why does it seem to be the odd man out among Midwest states and the will of the lawmakers in spite of the will of the people on issues like gay marriage?
Todd, I wish I had an answer for that. I don't know. We're definitely getting Christians involved in this issue now as we go forward with this. In fact, I can't tell you how many people are calling our 800 number, our toll-free number, sending an email saying, thank you for doing something about this. People want to do something about this. So maybe it's just been an apathy of among people in Illinois not to actually get involved in their government, and this has given them a chance to do so.
How many signatures are needed for the advisory referendum to actually see the light of day?
All right, we need 283,000 signatures by April 20th is our internal deadline so we can bind them. But, yeah, 283,000. So our actual goal is 500,000 since there's about a 20 to 30% throwout rate. If you're not registered to vote and you sign your name, well, we can't count that. So we're going for 500,000 signatures by April 20th.
What can our Illinois listeners do? How do they get access to this referendum and their ability to put their name as valid voters in the state of Illinois on the petition?
Well, thanks, Todd. First of all, they can visit our website, which is protectmarriageillinois.org, which is all spelled out, protectmarriageillinois.org, or they can call me toll-free at 877-787-8011. Now, we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of good people who have taken the petition to their churches, to their family, to their friends, to their coworkers. And I keep telling people, many hands make light work. 283,000 names sounds like a huge number. It is. It's a daunting task. But when there's a lot of God's people working on this, this can be accomplished in a short order.
Where does this go from here? At least according to the Post-Dispatch story, there are 35,000 signatures so far. Do you anticipate getting the necessary basic quarter of a million signatures?
Absolutely, absolutely. We have just received the Catholic bishops and Cardinal George's endorsement. We've got the Missouri Synod Lutheran's endorsement. We've got the Illinois State Baptist Association. We've got Mormons working with us and Muslims working with us. And if I keep evangelical free churches working with us, it's amazing how many people are coming on board now and rolling up their sleeves and saying, let's get this done.
One of the things pointed out late in the story in the paper is that, and this is, I think, proven to be true nationwide as well, that when people are asked, or Illinois voters are asked, about gay marriage, the words used often are a big determining factor as to how they answer opinion polls. When marriage is used, they generally say, no, we don't want gay marriage, but if something like civil unions is used, then they generally are less opposed. How do you sort that out?
Well, it's just a matter of education. Civil unions is nothing more than marriage by a different name. It is still giving the government's imperature to a recognized and legally protected and promoted union, which, again, government shouldn't be in that business of promoting and protecting a very dangerous and unhealthy lifestyle.
And finally, why is it that this is necessary? If people read in the paper that it's a largely symbolic gesture, powerful symbolism nonetheless. Why is this advisory referendum necessary?
Well, I would disagree. It is very necessary simply because if you look at what's happening only in Canada recently and in the Netherlands, marriage is disappearing because it suddenly loses all meaning. If marriage is no longer a sacred union of one man, one woman, but anything and anyone can go. Even, for example, in Utah, the ACLU sued on behalf of a polygamist who wanted to redefine marriage as a union between one man and many wives. You know, it loses all its meaning, and that's what's happening out there in the Scandinavian countries and now in Canada.
And to those who say, look, the government should not delve into such matters, it is not the government's business to say yay or nay on what they would say is essentially personal decisions and personal relationships and matters of love, how do you respond?
Well, again, you know, we are a country and a government of the people, by the people, for the people. We have every right to get involved in matters of public policy. No one's suggesting that homosexual couples can't live together, they or associate in their, you know, gay bars or associations and clubs. Nobody's saying that. What we're saying is government shouldn't protect and promote this lifestyle.
ProtectMarriageIllinois.org is the website for Protect Marriage Illinois. ProtectMarriageIllinois.org. Dave Smith is Project Director for Protect Marriage Illinois. Dave, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you so much, Dad.
Bye. LCMS World Relief is an organization that is concerned about both body and soul. It is a relief agency that has genuine worldwide reach. 95 cents of every dollar given through LCMS World Relief reaches the target, whether it is someone in Sudan, whether it is someone in Sri Lanka, whether it is someone in Louisiana, whether it is someone affected by the recent earthquakes in the Far East. LCMS World Relief attaches to its relief efforts to the very needs of body the greater need of soul, that is, the message of Christ and Him crucified for sinners, and it does it consciously and unapologetically. They're a proud underwriter of Issues Etc. You can find out about them at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can donate directly by calling 1-888-930-4438. When you call that number, mention that you heard about it on Issues Etc. 1-888-930-4438. 38, LCMS World Relief, Christ-centered and cross-focused relief efforts concerned for both body and soul. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to be talking with Greg Kokel, answering the question, where is God in disaster? Where was he? I just picked up the latest National Geographic, and they had long pictorial expose of what's going on in Louisiana, what's going on in New Orleans. Unbelievable to see these pictures. I mean, for a guy like me who doesn't watch a lot of television, doesn't see a lot of the pictures, it is the stark reality, and the tagline there is, it's worse than you thought, and it certainly is. The ongoing need is there. Where was God? Where is he now that people are still trying to put their lives together? Greg Kokel will be our guest in just a moment to talk about that. And then, the last 45 minutes of Issues Etc., we continue a conversation with Uwe Simonetto, international journalist, talking about our vocation as Christians when it comes to watching television, reading the papers, reading the magazines, going online, doing everything that we do as media consumers. That's coming up here in about 25 minutes on Issues Etc. Greg Kokel is a regular guest. He is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, and he's author of an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled, Where Was God When the Recent Hurricane Struck the Gulf Coast? Greg, welcome back.
Hey, Todd.
Well, I want to go at something that you don't get to until the middle of your article, but that is the way we are selective about what we call disasters and the moral implications that we attach to those carefully selected disasters. What do you mean when you say we're selective about what we call disasters?
It's very understandable when people raise the question, where was God when we have things like Katrina and the like? But the interesting thing is, I mentioned in the article Columbine High School, which is now 4 or 5 years gone, but it's still, I mean, a fresh example of people saying, where was God when that happened? There are two different types of evil, moral evil of human beings, and then you have the evil of, say, natural evil of a hurricane. But still the same question is, where was God? And the observation I made recently was the same observation I made years ago when we had the Oklahoma City bombing, same question asked there. And I thought, you know, I wonder how many people who are raising this question, where was God during this tragedy? Why didn't he step in and not allow this kind of thing to happen? I wonder how many of them were in the process of committing adultery or fornication or something like that on the same day that this event that they're complaining about actually happened. And when you think about adultery, you think about something that, it turns out, is very, very destructive to human relationships. You think about the marriages, all of the adulteries committed that day, and the marriages that were destroyed as a result of that, the children that were harmed because of that, the families that were split up as a result, the children kind of cast adrift as a result of that kind of split up. I mean, on the days when these big events happened, in which people wonder where was God, and they ask that question, think of the cumulative effect of all of those adulteries and the harm on people's lives. But curiously, nobody's asking the question, where was God when I was committing my adultery? And the point that I'm making there is I'm just simply pointing out that the time that we complain about the problem of evil is only when the problem of evil seems to hurt us one way or another, either directly or indirectly. Indirectly, we're watching it on TV and we're anguished by what we see there, even though we're not personally touched by it. But it's the times when it touches us in some way in the negative that we are concerned why God didn't act, but we don't ask the same question when we are the ones that are perpetrators of the evil that is causing damage in other people's lives, but when we do that, we're getting pleasure out of it. And it just makes me wonder about the way we, as I mentioned in the article, pick and choose our moral tragedies. Turns out there's all kinds of evil in the world, and if God were to deal with all of the evil tonight at midnight, where would everybody else be at 12:01? we would be cinderfied, Todd, because when God deals with evil, he's going to do a complete job. And so sometimes we don't actually realize what it is we're asking of God, deal with the problem of evil, when we are the ones, our hands are on the smoking gun, and we're the ones who are often guiltiest of evil that hurts other people. I'm trying to put this whole problem in perspective. I think the problem of evil, tragedy like we've seen here in the last year or so, is one of the most difficult things to respond to. And so instead of trying to give a total and whole and complete response, because I don't think that's possible, I think there are unanswerable aspects to this. There are mysterious aspects to this. But still, I ask the question, which worldview, which point of view about reality, which religious view has the most resources to do a good job in dealing with this? And I think that the Christian worldview has the most resources to answer this. And one of the things it points out is that it doesn't sanitize the problem of evil from God's perspective or with regards to human beings. And it takes the position that a lot of the evil that is allowed in this world that we complain about is evil that we ourselves are perpetrators of.
Greg Kokel is our guest going into this break. Feel free to join us in our conversation. Continues for the next 25 minutes of Issues Etc., answering the question, where is God in disaster? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Greg is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. You can check out their newly designed website. Just go to ours, Issues. It's the same old website for us, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Click links on the left-hand side of the page. Scroll down. You'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Our website address again, issuesetc.org. When we come back, well, Greg used a very interesting term there, sanitizing the problem of evil. I want to know exactly what he means by that. An attempt to defend God against unjust accusations. And what about some of the answers to the question, where is God in disaster, that are being given by Christians but turn out in the end to be the wrong answers? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is a place for forming pastors, not just an academic ivory tower.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Leonard Payton, on his experience as a student at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Certainly great Bible teaching. Professors are godly men, and they have time for students. Several professors are deep in pastoral experience. This is a place for forming pastors, not just an academic ivory tower. A well-planned daily chapel program models the conduct of the service. We learn what to do. Fort Wayne has decent schools and lots of strong, unashamedly Lutheran churches. It's been a great place for me and my family.
For more information or to schedule an on-campus visit, call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, 1-800-481-2155, or visit them on the web, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The attacks on Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito are getting personal. Colorado Senator Ken Salazar told the New York Times that America deserves better than Alito, who is one of the most experienced judges ever to come before the Senate for confirmation. Alito supporters say the comments are uninformed at best. Steve Jordahl reports.
Speaking about the chances of a filibuster of Judge Alito, Senator Salazar was quoted as saying, America deserves better than what we got here. Cody Wirtz is Salazar's press secretary.
America deserves a justice in the mold of Sandra Day O'Connor, a moderate judge that will not turn back the court to pre-Warren days.
The clarification did little to mollify Peter Brandt to focus on the family action.
Well, I'm shocked. This is the kind of comments or language that one would expect from a city councilman in a tiny little town. What we have here is a senator who is not willing to look at a nominee on face value based on the qualifications.
Professor John Eastman of Chapman University School of Law says when judged on qualifications for the bench, Alito is the strongest candidate in the last 70 years.
This is more than just the A team we're talking about here. Sam Alito is an all-star of judicial nominations. I mean, this is one of the stronger appointments that could have been made.
Alito was unanimously confirmed by the Senate twice and has received the American Bar Association's highest rating of well-qualified.
There were probably a half a dozen people in the country that were in his league.
Some are suggesting that Salazar's comments indicate that what America really needs is a better senator. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Eastman says Alito has argued 12 cases before the Supreme Court, and as a U.S. attorney, was the top prosecutor in one of the largest federal districts in America. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
AM 850 KFUO wants you to have a very Merry Christmas. So we're giving you a chance to win a Build-A-Bear Workshop Christmas teddy bear. All you have to do is
listen for the jingle bells.
That's your cue to call and register. One registration per family, please. Then we'll draw and award one Build-A-Bear Workshop bear on the first three Fridays in December. See the cute, cuddly bears on our homepage at KFUO.org. And
listen for the jingle bells
on AM 850 KFUO.
If you've ever wondered about the issues that were the basis for agreement and disagreement during the Reformation, we have a book for you. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November is titled Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions, a reader's edition of the Book of Concord. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or look for the cover of Concordia, the Lutheran Confessions on our website, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Greg Kokel is our guest answering the question, where is God in disaster? I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation with Greg, picking up the latest, I think it was National Geographic. It might have been thumbing through Time magazine over the holiday weekend. I don't know. One of those big magazines had a pictorial depiction of the state of affairs right now in Louisiana and in particular in New Orleans. And it just is terrible. It's unbelievable the amount of work that needs to be done there and the amount of devastation that was wrought. And where was God? Greg, before the break, you used an odd term, an odd phrase, sanitizing the problem of evil. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are two players in this problem, human beings and God. And usually the objection is raised against God, and we kind of take ourselves out of play here. Why does God allow this evil? And when I made my comments about picking and choosing our moral tragedies, I was trying to point out that, you know, we're not the innocent bystanders here. So much of the evil that we complain about are evil at the hands of human beings. And the irony is that human beings perpetuate evil with evil intentions. We don't complain when we're the perpetrators of evil. We only complain when people, and God allows other people to be perpetrators of evil towards us. And then when human beings do terribly evil things, we lose our confidence in God, but we still believe in human beings. And this shows that some people just aren't interested in looking at the facts. So we try to sanitize the human contribution, and I think that needs to be looked at to put this into perspective. But I think on the other side, theists of all sorts, including Christians, get uncomfortable for God here, and they want to try to sanitize God, and they want to say, well, you know, God has nothing to do with this problem. one thing they might say is they say, well, you know, God is weeping along with us. This is Rabbi Harold Kushner's answer, and why do bad things happen to good people? His response essentially is that you got a broken-hearted God who is himself victimized and agonizing over events that are out of his control. He's limited in power and perfection, and therefore he weeps at the world along with us. So he can commiserate with us because he's equally victimized. Well, that, in one sense, I guess, rescues God from the responsibility, but at the same time, it does so at the cost of his sovereignty and his power and his greatness. Who wants to worship a God who's just as victimized by evil as we are? I don't think that's the right answer.
So if we hear maybe the more common way of hearing that response is, you know, where was God in disaster? Well, God isn't a player in the disaster. This was a natural occurrence, merely a normal course of nature and of the weather. And we don't know what God was doing, but he certainly was playing no part in it whatsoever.
Yeah, see, I couldn't say that, Todd, as a biblical Christian. If I were a deist of some sort, God wound up the world and just let it run on its own, that would be an accessible answer or an applicable answer. But for me as a Christian, I have a much more robust understanding of God's involvement in the details of human affairs, including his control over natural things. I'm not saying that he commands and directs every single hurricane or whatever. I'm saying that these might be the outworking of natural processes that were placed in a position a long time ago, but they are only outworking under the sovereign control and permission of God. And so this then raises a question, then, why didn't God stop these things? And I think ultimately, I've been reading the last couple of weeks through the book of Job, and I think what one of the lessons that we learn from the book of Job is that God, to some degree, has mysterious intents about these things, and he doesn't need to answer to us. Now, I don't think we should just dismiss the question. I think a lot could be said about it. But I don't think either as Christians that we have to somehow sanitize God and show him to everybody that he is not responsible for anything, he's not involved in this, it's out of his control. You can't put any blame on God, because I don't think that's the answer that God gives us when he talks to Job about this issue. He basically tells Job, who himself was the innocent victim of suffering, both of a moral nature from people who marauded and killed his children, and natural disaster, and you know the disease that bothered his body, and God, you know, he didn't give Job the answers that Job was looking for. Basically, God said, "I am God, and I know what I'm doing." And sometimes God's people have to get to a point of simply saying, "Yeah, we can answer some of this stuff, but we've got to be comfortable to some degree with God being God." And that's what I meant about sanitizing this even from God's perspective.
How do you respond to the person? I heard this a number of times, especially after Katrina, especially when kind of the metaphorical wave of the tragedy was still kind of washing over the nation. People were trying to get their arms around how big and how devastating these storms were. Some people simply concluded, look, this is proof, if we needed any more proof, this is proof that God doesn't exist, that we live in a universe driven by nothing but the blind forces of nature.
Well, I don't know why that would be the case. If somebody thinks that is proof, I think they've got to offer the proof. They can't just say that. How is it that when you have forces of nature that devastate portions of the earth, how does it follow from that God can't exist? I don't understand that. Certainly it doesn't follow that the God of Christianity doesn't exist, because when we read in the Bible, given the Christian worldview, these kinds of things are what you'd ought to expect in a world that is in rebellion against God, and that there are consequences even in the natural order to human moral sin and moral rebellion against God. This kind of, you know, people say, well, how do you account for this kind of thing? How do you answer this kind of thing? So we don't have to answer it. The Bible predicts this kind of thing. This is precisely what you'd expect in the kind of world that the Bible describes as real. All of these things fit into our worldview. And I'm actually quite surprised when Christians raise the alarm themselves when they say, gee, how could God allow such thing? Well, maybe they should spend more time in the Scripture to see the kinds of things that God allowed. You know, we just had Thanksgiving a couple of days ago, and I read to our family around dinner an account of the early pilgrims and the Mayflower and the whole thing. You know, those people suffered immensely during this this dangerous trip to the New World in their first couple of seasons, and more than half of them died the first winter of that group that came in the Mayflower. But, you know, they were Christians that were deeply committed to God and saw God intervene in miraculous ways, not to save everybody, but to save a remnant. And so they had a very sober understanding of what it's like to live in the contingencies of a fallen world. But in the midst of those contingencies, they could see the hand of God rescuing at particular points. And I have a niece that's right now working in New Orleans. She left her job in Washington, D.C., and she's spending 12 to 18-hour days, 7 days a week, working to help those people. This is an act of goodness that would not have been possible if something tragic like Katrina had not happened to that town. Now, some people might say, well, I don't know, how could the goodness outweigh all the badness that actually took place? Well, we're not in a position to assess that, frankly, Todd. The only person who's in a position to assess that is God himself. I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt to him on this kind of thing, that he knows what he's doing when he allows these kinds of things. And he allows the great goodness that is a result of a whole nation responding, as you saw and everybody saw, to this disaster by giving out of their pockets when many of these people never gave before at all. So there was a tremendous amount of goodness that did result from the badness of that disaster that needs to be taken into consideration when we calculate, when we consider the calculus of this of the moral nature of this event.
We're talking about Where is God in Disaster. Greg Kokel is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. DB calls from his car. DB, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Hi, DB.
I just had a brief point, but I thought about this question quite a bit, and I think there are a lot of unanswered questions as to the specifics of why certain events occur.
Right.
But we understand that God is sovereign. I agree at that point entirely. And on top of that, I think the way people often view God is he's this some kind of cruel taskmaster up in heaven who just allows these things to happen and doesn't intervene in them, or he does these things in a cruel way. But people forget, even Christians forget, that God himself in the person of Christ bore evil for us. I mean,
right.
He experienced the ultimate suffering on my behalf, and it was my fault that Christ suffered.
Right.
And so therefore, somebody who didn't deserve any kind of pain or suffering, I mean, we could say any evil that befalls me in my life, I'm never innocent of completely. Maybe it's not directly my fault, but I'm a sinner. But Christ deserved no suffering, no evil to befall on him, and yet he willingly took that on for me. So it's not a light question. It's not as if God is this cruel person allowing these things just to go on. He willingly entered into history and suffered himself, and therefore, what occurs must occur according to God's sovereign plan. Otherwise, why would he himself, you know, become part of that? Why would he take on suffering when he certainly didn't deserve it?
Thanks, DB.
Thank you, DB. That's a great observation. I mean, talk about the innocent suffering. Here is the most innocent one who suffered the most, and he did it as a choice of love for the redemption of the human beings who made the problem to begin with. This is why I think that thinking of the Christian worldview, Todd, as a whole, is so helpful. I don't try to solve problems just by looking at little incidental things and trying to attach little kind of spiritual phrases to them. I try to look at the whole picture of Christianity. I mentioned a few moments ago when you consider the Christian worldview, this is precisely the kind of thing that you'd expect to happen if the Christian worldview is an accurate picture of reality. God made everything originally, and he made it good. It was just the way he wanted it. Then he created human beings with moral freedom that they used to rebel against God, and all kinds of tragic things followed. Now, God has a redemption plan, and that plan is in place, and it entailed him becoming a man himself and coming to this earth and suffering as an innocent one, and intervening at different times to mitigate the impact of suffering that human beings brought on themselves by sinning against God initially. But heaven isn't now. The kingdom isn't now in its fullest sense. There will be a time in the future where the author will walk on the stage and all of this mess will be done with. But as C.S. Lewis points out, when the author walks on the stage, the play is over. That means there's no further chance for redemption. And I think this is where something Peter writes in 2 Peter chapter 3 is very, very helpful, Todd. Peter says that God is not slow with regards to his promise, as some call count slowness. You know, where is God? He says, rather, he is long-suffering, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. There is a period of time now where God is letting evil have a reign, its reign within measure, within certain a control, because for God to deal with evil totally would be to remove any opportunity for evil people to be forgiven. Instead of receiving justice that we deserve, God is first extending mercy. And that's why we have this period where evil reigns and we are impacted by it. We are victimized by it. Because through this all, Jesus is offering an opportunity for forgiveness. He is not slow according to his promise, but long-suffering, not wishing that any should perish, but all come to a knowledge of him and redemption.
Calling from Kirkwood, Andy is on the line. Hi, Andy.
Right along the same lines that you've been talking about. One of my problems with those who call things that happen evil is, who is it that decides what's evil? And you go back to Genesis 3, and you find that this is one of the original temptations. You can decide for yourself what's good and evil. And that hooks Adam and Eve right up. They say, oh, that'd be a good thing. We could be like gods. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those who are saying, oh, this is evil, they're playing God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I think even non-believers can identify things that are truly evil, and they, even if they don't believe in God, they still have this capacity, this moral intuition, this capacity given by God to see things. But I think that you are touching on another problem that I really agree with, and that is, without God, you can't have any good and evil. That is, that there's no proper way to understand good and evil. Without God, you've got basically just human opinions about what they like and what they don't like, because there's no objective standard. There's no universal. There's no transcendent standard of right and wrong that God's character provides that allows us to call anything evil. I think about this famous statement by the great 20th century British philosopher Bertrand Russell, who said, how can you talk about God when you're kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Well, this is a very powerful statement. It has great rhetorical force. You think, boy, how could you do that? And then I heard Dr. William Lane Craig, the Christian philosopher, give response to Bertrand Russell. And his response was this. He says, what is Bertrand Russell going to say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Tough luck? That's the way it goes? I mean, a Bertrand Russell can't even call it morally tragic, because there's no grounds for moral tragedy if you're an atheist. It's just stuff that happens. You know, Hitler is stuff and Mother Teresa is stuff, and it's just stuff. They're different kinds of stuff, but ultimately the difference between evil and good is diminished and disappears if there is no God. And this is why I say I keep coming back to the point that I think Christianity has the resources to answer the challenge the best. Even though there are gaps in the answers, and we have to fall back on the sovereignty and the wisdom of God, as God instructed in the book of Job, I still think that we can do a better job than anybody, certainly the atheists, who also have to answer the problem of evil, but they have an additional problem, Todd. They have to deal with the problem of good as well, and they can't answer that one either.
You mentioned before the calculus, and it's evident from our conversation so far, Greg, that someone who says in order for Christianity and its worldview to be valid, it has to provide the complete formula, the chalkboard with every element of the equation in place. It all balances out in the end, and it is a perfect symmetry of logic and sense, and it has to make complete sense to me. But it sounds like you're saying, look, when you're dealing with God and when you're dealing with fallen creatures, the nice, neat answers are not necessarily the answers that you will always get when it comes to tragedy.
Yeah, I'm kind of saying that. It's actually worse than that for the objector here, because my response is, let's just take God out of the picture, okay? Let's just say he doesn't exist. Christians are all wrong. We don't have this nice, neat thing that answers everything. Okay, now what? What are you going to do? You think atheism is any more tidy? Atheism is a lot less adequate to deal with these problems. Any other religious view, any philosophy you take, even if you say, I'm not going to make any decision, I'm going to be agnostic, I'm going to be a skeptic. Well, now you've taken a position, haven't you? And your position as an agnostic or skeptic certainly doesn't satisfy the requirements that you just offered to Christianity. Those basically, the problem is, Todd, is the world is messy. You know, it isn't that just Christianity can't answer things totally to one person's satisfaction. It's that no view can. And it's not that no view is adequate ultimately to give the answers. It just means that as fallen human beings, we are limited in our ability to understand all of these things, and we can figure some things out, but we're not going to be able to figure other things out. And so every worldview, every religion, any option you take is going to have those problems. So given that that's the state of affairs of the limits of our knowing, we, I think, are obliged then rationally and by common sense to try to go with the answer that does the best job of answering the questions and resolving the issues, even though it doesn't provide all of the answers for us right now. And I think that, hands down, Christianity far and away does that.
I'd like to hear your response. This was a statement often reported in the press after Katrina and Rita, and it was made by son of Billy Graham, Franklin Graham. And I don't know whether it's completely in context or not, but the way it was reported was Graham saying, look, it's very easy from a Christian point of view what happened down there. You had New Orleans, city of notorious iniquity.
Yeah.
And this is what eventually happens, you know. You poke the tiger, and the tiger's eventually going to bare his teeth.
Yeah, or the lion of the tribe of Judah is probably what he's referring to. It's very unfortunate that Franklin Graham made this comment, because I think this is among the most foolish things that people, Christians, say around times like this. And I didn't know that Franklin was capable of this kind of foolishness. Now, let me just point out, this is a knee-jerk reaction. God must be judging us for this New Orleans. You know, the interesting thing about New Orleans is that what's the worst part of New Orleans? The French Quarter.
Right, Bourbon Street.
Yeah, Bourbon Street. Guess what area of New Orleans was untouched by this enterprise? Bourbon Street. It wasn't washed out. It was on high ground. And so when the dikes burst, it destroyed a whole bunch of other areas. But Bourbon Street was spared. So you'd think it would be just the opposite. If God was going to judge New Orleans because of the iniquity, God would do a surgical strike on the place where most of the iniquity was. It turns out that not only was New Orleans or Bourbon Street and the French Quarter spared, but within a couple of weeks after the storm, homosexuals are having a gay pride parade right down the middle of the street celebrating the survival of their section of the town. So further, you know, generally God judges after he's given a clear warning to the people about what he's going to do. I think it's presumptuous to speak for God in a situation like this, especially when it seems like the evidence goes the other direction. You know, if somebody said God is going to destroy the French Quarter because of its iniquity, and then a week later a hurricane came through and the rest of the city was untouched, except for the French Quarter, which was flattened, well, then I think we'd be justified in making that observation. But in the absence of something like that, I think it just makes Christians look foolish.
It does provide some sort of, and I think why Christians, even someone like Franklin Graham, says it, it provides some sense of, okay, at least that kind of, or at least they'll say, that kind of fits with this whole notion of sin, and this kind of fits with the whole notion of how God deals with sin. And so that's a valid response in the Christian worldview. And I take it you would pretty heartily disagree.
Well, I think it is a valid kind of response, but I don't think it applies in this circumstance for the reasons that I gave you. I think that another valid kind of response is what I've been offering. So the Christian worldview has the resources to respond in different ways depending on the facts. I just think this is a kind of a pietistic, what is viewed as a pietistic, condescending judgment by a Christian leader on the rest of the world. Oh, here's why this happened, because of you nasty, dirty sinners. Now, never mind that the nasty, dirty sinners didn't get targeted for this, and a whole bunch of innocent people got targeted for this. We're just going to ignore that kind of thing. I think there are times when God judges. Certainly we see this in the Scripture, and in the modern times, maybe there's a surgical strike. But I think we have to be justified in making that point based on the circumstances themselves, rather than just offering this as a blanket statement, like when some of our leaders said, well, 9-1-1 was a judgment by God against pornography and abortion and, you know, that kind of stuff in this country. And that was a Christian leader there. One thing that particular Christian leader didn't include in his list was the church. that was excessively fleshly, I think they could have been considered a contributor. But I think those are unwise kinds of characterizations, given the kinds of facts that we have on those incidents we face, Katrina, 911, things like that. Under other circumstances, it might be a fair assessment, but under these, I don't think so.
Finally, with 1 minute here, you write, our dilemma should not be why God allows evil. Instead, our wonder should be why he would pay such an incredible price to rescue us
right.
at all when we have rebelled so completely. Your final thoughts with a minute.
Yeah, well, that kind of sums it up for me. I think we end up spinning our wheels. People end up spinning their wheels because we think God owes us something. We created a mess, and then when we have to sit in our own stink, then we blame God for it. Instead, we should be looking to ourselves and saying, gee, we got ourselves into a mess. Maybe we should be turning to God and asking for forgiveness rather than complaining because he didn't do enough.
Folks, you can receive Greg Kokel's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling 1-800-2-REASON. 1-800, the number 2, REASON, R-E-A-S-O-N. It's called Solid Ground, 1-800-2-REASON. Greg, thanks for being our guest.
And have a great Christmas, Todd.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, author of an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled, Where Was God When the Recent Hurricane Struck the Gulf Coast? The number again, 1-800-2-REASON. When we come back from this break, we've got hour three of Issues Etc. ahead, a 40-minute hour during these dark days of the fall and winter season. Uwe Simonetto joins us. Last week, we talked with him, beginning our series on Christian vocation. We talked about the vocation he knows best, which is that of journalist. Well, on the other side of that coin are the rest of us, those who consume what journalists and the media produce. Now, the media is the most general term that has really the most common parlance among us nowadays. When we say media, what do you picture? You picture television and cable. You picture the internet. You picture magazines and newspapers. You picture radio. It's all the media, and we all consume it. So is it part of our Christian vocation? Some would say it isn't. That any consumption of the media, of the secular media, is going to stain your hands. Some Christians say what we need is an unsecular media, a sacred media. We need television and radio and newspapers and magazines tailored just for us, with Christian journalists and Christian reporters and Christian personalities and Christian sitcoms all talking to us Christians. Are they shirking their vocation as media consumers? We'll talk about that with Uwe Simonetto, international journalist. He joins us here in Studio A right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.